June 1st, 1983. Louisville, Kentucky. 12-year-old Ann Gottlieb leaves her friend's residence in order to ride her bicycle back to her family's apartment, but she never arrives. When Ann's mother goes searching for her, she discovers Ann's abandoned bicycle outside a department store, but no trace of her can be found. 25 years later, investigators announce that new evidence seems to point towards a convicted sex offender named Gregory Oakley, but since he is currently deceased, there is no resolution in Ann's disappearance. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to explore an unsolved missing children's case, the 1983 disappearance of 12-year-old Ann Gottlieb. I originally received a request to cover this one last year from a listener named Tyler, and surprisingly, it does not look like it has been featured on too many other podcasts, even though it's often cited as one of the cases which signaled a major turning point in missing children's investigations. Ann Gottlieb was originally born in the Soviet Union before she emigrated to the United States with her parents, but only 3 years after their arrival, Ann vanished while biking home. Ann's bicycle would be found outside a mall department store, and the evidence clearly seemed to indicate that she had been abducted. But what was particularly shocking is that Ann's disappearance occurred in broad daylight in a public place that was pretty much across the street from her family's apartment, yet no one saw anything. This demonstrated that child abductions could occur at any place, at any time, and would be one of the cases which helped lead to the formation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children the following year. In 2008, investigators would publicly announce their belief that a convicted felon named Gregory Oakley was responsible for Ann's disappearance, and even though he passed away years earlier, they felt the evidence would have been strong enough to arrest Oakley if he was still alive. However, since Ann's body has still not been found, this offered very little comfort for her family. There is technically not a smoking gun to prove with absolute certainty that Oakley committed this crime, which is why it officially remains unsolved, so we're going to explore all the different angles on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Ann Gottlieb. Our story begins in Louisville, Kentucky in 1983, and our central figure is 12-year-old Ann Gottlieb. Ann was originally born in Kiev, the capital of Soviet Ukraine, which was then a republic of the Soviet Union. She was the only child of her Jewish parents, Anatoly and Ludmila Gottlieb, and in 1980, the family decided to emigrate to the United States. They would settle in Louisville, and in spite of the massive cultural change, Ann proved to be fluent in both English and Russian, and was a particularly smart kid in school, so much so that she wound up skipping the fifth grade. On June the 1st, which happened to be the first day of summer break, Ann left her family's apartment on Gerald Court to take the bus to the city's Jewish Community Center. She spent the afternoon there playing tennis with one of her friends, before the friend's mother gave Anne a ride home. After she arrived, Anne immediately hopped on her bicycle and rode to the home of her best friend, Tanya Okmyansky, which was located about a mile away. They spent the next hour watching TV together, but at around 5:30 p.m., Ludmila Gottlieb phoned the residence in order to ask Anne to return home for dinner. Anne and Tanya rode their respective bicycles to the parking lot of the Bashford Manor Mall, which was located across the street from Anne's apartment, but after the two friends went their separate ways, Anne never arrived home. At the time, Anatoly was out of town, but when Anne failed to surface by 6 p.m., Ludmila grew concerned and went out searching for her. She eventually came across Anne's bicycle, which was now propped up against a brick pillar outside Bacon's department store, located on the southeast side of the Bashford Manor Mall. Ludmila noticed that the bike's kickstand was down, even though it was broken at the time, and Anne never used it. This seemed to indicate that someone else had placed the bicycle there, so Ludmila immediately contacted the police in order to report Anne missing. A massive search effort was launched for Anne, and the FBI would eventually become involved in the investigation. 3 days after Anne originally went missing, a police bloodhound seemed to pick up her scent around a drainage ditch near the mall, and the dog soon led them towards an open window at a nearby apartment complex. The apartment just happened to belong to Esther Okmyansky, the grandmother of Anne's friend, Tanya Okmyansky, who was the last known person to see Anne alive. In spite of the presence of her scent, Esther maintained that Anne had not visited her apartment at all on the day she went missing. While this seemed like an odd coincidence, an extensive investigation into the Okmyansky family cleared them of any involvement in Anne's disappearance. Police would eventually come to believe that the only reason the bloodhound led them to Esther's apartment was because she happened to be cooking food at the time, and the dog was distracted by the smell through the open window. Investigators would explore the possibility that Anne might have run away voluntarily because she was having trouble adjusting to life in America. In fact, shortly before she went missing, Anne had been reading a book titled Still Missing, a fictional story about a 6-year-old boy who goes missing before his mother discovers his bicycle standing against a wall. But ultimately, it seemed like this was nothing more than yet another odd coincidence. The Gottliebs completely dismissed the possibility that Anne ran away, as she had no money on her and left behind all of her personal possessions. Another odd theory which was floated around was that Anne had been abducted by Russian government agents in an attempt to force her parents to return to the Soviet Union. However, this theory was quickly discounted by both the family and the FBI, and the Gottliebs insisted that they did not have any knowledge of important information which would have made them targets of the Soviet government. In the early stages of the investigation, the police were certain they had a promising suspect and circulated a composite sketch of an unidentified man in a white floppy golf hat. At around 2 p.m. on the afternoon of Anne's disappearance, a man matching this description had accosted a 10-year-old girl on a jogging track near the tennis court at the Jewish Community Center. He was seen saying obscene things to the girl before he grabbed her and attempted to pull her pants down, but he wound up fleeing the scene when the girl's mother intervened. He also reportedly harassed a woman who was sunbathing about a block away from the community center, and later that afternoon, he exposed himself to a pair of 6-year-old girls on a residential street located a few miles away from the Bashford Manor Mall. Since Anne had been playing tennis at the Jewish Community Center around the approximate time period this man was seen there, he immediately became a person of interest. It was soon identified as 42-year-old Ralph Barry Barber, who lived in the town of Nicholasville and had a history of arrests for sexual offenses. Barber was arrested and charged with sexual abuse, harassment, exposure, and unlawful transaction with a minor, and while he admitted to having committed these offenses that afternoon, he denied any involvement in Anne's disappearance. It turned out that Barber had a solid alibi, as following these other incidents, he left Louisville and traveled to Lexington to visit a trophy shop. 3 employees from the shop placed Barber there between 5:30 and 6 p.m., the approximate time period when Anne was abducted, so he wound up being dismissed as a suspect. Over the next several years, there would be a number of sightings of Anne at various locations throughout the United States, but but none of them ever panned out. In June of 1984, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, aka the NCMEC, was established. The organization sought to improve law enforcement investigations into unsolved missing children's cases, as well as spread awareness of their stories. The disappearance of Ann Gottlieb is often cited as one of the cases from that time period which helped lead to the creation of the NCMEC, and on the day the center officially opened, the first missing child poster which they started circulating was hers, and it would be printed in 5 different languages, including Russian. The next major development would occur in March of 1990, when a convicted serial killer named Michael Lee Lockhart confessed to Ann's abduction and murder. At the time, Lockhart was on death row at the Huntsville unit in Texas for the murders of 3 victims, including a police officer and 2 teenage girls, though he often claimed that he was actually responsible for the murders of around 20 to 30 girls. Lockhart claimed that after he killed Ann, he buried her body on land located near Fort Knox. Well, it turned out that Lockhart had been stationed at Fort Knox in 1983, and since it was located south of Louisville, his story did not seem completely implausible. However, Lockhart failed a polygraph when questioned about the case, and an extensive search of the alleged burial site near Fort Knox turned up nothing. In the end, no evidence was ever found to link Lockhart to Ann's disappearance, and he was executed in December of 1997. The investigation remained at a standstill for years, until the media covered a memorial which was held to commemorate the 25th anniversary of Ann's disappearance in June of 2008. 2 days later, the Louisville Metro Police Department was contacted by a woman named Virginia Bailey, who shared some incriminating information about a man named Gregory Lewis Oakley Jr. Oakley originally hailed from Alabama and had once worked as a veterinarian, but he also had a history of troubling behavior with young girls. Oakley went through 3 marriages, but his first 2 wives were only 17 and 15 years old respectively at the time they originally got married. In November of 1981, Oakley was living in Birmingham with his 3rd wife, and while she was recovering in the hospital, he set his sights on his 13-year-old stepdaughter. After luring his stepdaughter into his car under the pretense of visiting her mother in the hospital, Oakley injected the girl with the painkiller Demerol in order to sedate her before he took her to a motel room to sexually assault her. While Oakley was initially charged with rape and first-degree assault, the charges were later downgraded to second-degree assault, and after Oakley pleaded guilty, he only received a sentence of 2 years probation. However, police started looking into an incident from July of 1979 in which a 13-year-old girl was attacked outside a YMCA in Birmingham by a man with a hypodermic needle. She was also injected with Demerol, though it sounds like the attacker was forced to flee the scene before he could sexually assault her. Given the similarities to the assault on Oakley's stepdaughter, the police decided to reinvestigate the incident, and Oakley would be positively identified as her attacker. Oakley was charged with assault with intent to murder, and while he was later convicted of the crime, he was only sentenced to time served and never went to prison. Since the attacks caused Oakley to lose his veterinarian's license, he decided to move to Louisville near the end of 1982 and got a job as a meat inspector for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who were unaware of his past criminal record. In September of 1983, only 3 months after Ann Gottlieb's disappearance, Oakley entered the home of a 13-year-old girl named Lee Mooney, who lived only about 1.5 miles away from where Ann disappeared. Oakley threatened Lee with a knife and demanded that she take off her clothes, but when she attempted to fight back and put up a struggle, Oakley stabbed her in the back. However, Lee just happened to be the daughter of a Louisville police officer, and she told Oakley that he was going to be arriving home at any minute and would blow his brains out. This seemed to scare Oakley off, so he fled the house, and Lee survived the attack. Lee saw Oakley driving away in a black pickup truck, and this description allowed police to eventually track him down. When Lee identified him as her attacker, Oakley was arrested and charged with attempted rape and burglary in January of 1984. It turned out that Oakley had lived only about 1 block north from the Gottliebs' apartment, so while he was in custody, investigators began questioning him about Ann's disappearance, and he wound up failing a polygraph test. ATM records showed that Oakley had made a transaction at the bank near the Bashford Manor Mall only about 100 minutes before Ann went missing, but he maintained that he immediately left Louisville on a business trip right after the transaction was made. In spite of their suspicions, investigators did not have anything to conclusively link Oakley to Ann's abduction, but he would be convicted of the attack on Lee Mooney and received a 30-year prison sentence. By 2002, Oakley had developed terminal lung cancer, so when he went in front of the parole board in June of that year, they decided to grant him a medical pardon and release him from prison. He subsequently returned to his home state of Alabama, but passed away only 4 months later. Well, at the time Ann went missing, Oakley had been living with his girlfriend, Virginia Bailey, and the publicity surrounding the 25th anniversary of Ann's disappearance prompted her to come forward to police. According to Bailey, Oakley had left town on a work-related trip on May the 31st of 1983, but he unexpectedly returned home the following night at around 11 p.m., which was between 5 and 6 hours after the last confirmed sighting of Ann. Bailey said that Oakley appeared to be drunk and asked him to wash some clothes, which had traces of blood on them. Now, since Oakley worked as a meat inspector at a slaughterhouse, it was not uncommon for him to come home with blood on his clothing, but this was the first time he'd ever requested that Bailey wash them. But most importantly, this new information directly contradicted Oakley's original story that he had left Louisville on a business trip following his ATM transaction at the Bashford Manor Mall on June the 1st. Bailey also said that after Ann Gottlieb's disappearance made the news, she often heard Oakley speak about her case, and he once remarked that if they didn't find her shortly, she would be gone, and they would never find her. When Bailey decided to confront Oakley about his interest in Ann's case, he responded by striking her in the face, and he moved out of their house in July. On the basis of Bailey's story, investigators decided to revisit an old lead involving a burglar named Charles Cavins, who had served time with Oakley at the Luther Lockett Correctional Complex. At one point, Cavins had escaped from prison, but after he was picked up in March of 1992 and held in a city jail in Mount Carmel, Illinois, he asked to speak with detectives from the Jefferson County Police Department in order to discuss potentially making a deal with them in exchange for information. According to Cavins, at some point in 1989, Oakley had confessed to abducting Ann Gottlieb and injecting her with the painkiller drug Talwin. However, right when he was about to sexually assault her, Ann wound up having a negative reaction to the drug and vomiting, so Oakley strangled her to death in a fit of rage. He subsequently disposed of her body by wrapping it in a tarp and burying her. Cavins agreed to take multiple polygraph tests, but the results showed that he was being deceptive, so investigators suspected that he had fabricated the story. But the news story provided by Virginia Bailey prompted police to track down Cavins and re-interview him. He once again shared the same story about Oakley's alleged confession and agreed to take another polygraph. This time, he passed, and he also wrote out a statement confirming that Oakley's confession took place. In light of this new information, the Louisville Metro Police Department decided to hold a press conference in December of 2008, in which they publicly named Gregory Oakley as the prime suspect in Ann's disappearance. They seemed pretty certain that he was responsible, and stated that even without Ann's body, they believed the evidence against Oakley would have been strong enough to charge him with Ann's murder if he was still alive. The Gottliebs requested that the case be turned over to a grand jury for a posthumous indictment against Oakley, but the Commonwealth's attorney elected not to do so, since Oakley was deceased and could not mount a defense for himself. Even though the authorities continue to believe that Oakley was the perpetrator, they have not officially closed the investigation into Ann's disappearance and still hope to recover her remains someday. But for the moment, Ann Gottlieb continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, all unsolved missing children's cases are sad, But the circumstances of this one are particularly heartbreaking, as we have a family who made the move from the Soviet Union to the United States in order to provide a better life for their daughter, but she wound up disappearing only a few years after they arrived. And to make things even more tragic, Anne was Anatoly and Ludmilla's only child. The Gottliebs pretty much followed the same pattern as a lot of parents of missing children, in that they kept the same phone number for decades, on the off chance their daughter was still alive somewhere and would attempt to contact them. I'm not 100% certain if Anatoly and Ludmilla are still alive today, but if they are, they would both be getting up there in years, and they've had to deal with what is pretty much the most unsatisfactory conclusion the family of a missing victim can get. This is one of those cases where everyone seems to have a pretty good idea who the perpetrator was, but since they are already deceased, the chances of recovering the victim's remains and getting complete closure are not great. The last time I saw the Gottliebs get interviewed by the media was in 2010, and even though Gregory Oakley had already been identified as the likely perpetrator, they said they were still not 100% certain, because even though there was a pretty compelling circumstantial case against him, there was no smoking gun. And regardless of whether he did it or not, that doesn't change the fact that Anne has still never been found. Now, if there's one positive lasting legacy from Anne's story, it's the creation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which launched almost exactly 1 year after she went missing. One of the biggest advocates who helped create the NCMEC was future America's Most Wanted host John Walsh, because, as I'm sure you're well aware, his own 6-year-old son, Adam Walsh, was abducted from a mall department store in Hollywood, Florida, in July of 1981, before his severed head was found 2 weeks later. In fact, when a candlelight vigil was held on the 1-year anniversary of Anne's disappearance, John Walsh traveled to Louisville to attend. The formation of the NCMEC was the result of the frustration that Walsh and many other parents of missing children felt during that time period, as they often had to deal with law enforcement agencies who lacked resources for their investigations and did not do a good job of coordinating with each other. I'm going to talk about this more later on, but mistakes were made in the Anne Gottlieb investigation, and there's a chance that Gregory Oakley could have been conclusively linked to the crime months after she originally went missing. On October the 10th, 1983, a made-for-TV movie about Adam Walsh's murder, titled Adam, aired on NBC, and at one point during the broadcast, they showed a gallery of photographs of missing children who had not yet been found, and Anne Gottlieb was among them. You could definitely make a lot of parallels between the abductions of Anne Gottlieb and Adam Walsh, as they both disappeared from public shopping malls in broad daylight, and their cases played a role in helping people realize that a child could conceivably be abducted at any place at any time. In another crazy coincidence, the official press conference announcing that Gregory Oakley was likely responsible for Anne's abduction took place on December the 4th, 2008, and the press conference where police announced that Adam's case was being closed took place just 12 days later, on December the 16th. The authorities announced they were now satisfied that notorious serial killer Otis Toole, who had once confessed to Adam's murder, was responsible for the crime. But much like Gregory Oakley, Toole was already deceased by this point and could not be charged with the crime, so of course, there'll always be a bit of uncertainty that he was the right guy. Before I start talking more about Anne's case, I should mention that it also has a connection to one of the most controversial figures in the US right now, none other than current Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. At the time Anne went missing, McConnell happened to be Jefferson County Judge Executive and was also the chairman of the Kentucky Task Force on Exploited and Missing Children. McConnell did a number of interviews with the media while the original investigation was taking place, and if you do a search on YouTube, you can find a brief snippet of McConnell holding a press conference about the case alongside Anatoly and Ludmilla Gottlieb. So one of the main reasons this case sent major shockwaves throughout the community is that not only was Anne abducted in broad daylight in a public place, but it took place while she was directly across the street from her own apartment, and no one saw anything. In fact, the responsible party also apparently had the time to stand up Anne's bicycle next to a department store before leaving the scene, but no witnesses ever reported anything unusual. There are a lot of astonishing coincidences in this case, such as the fact that a bloodhound managed to track and scent to the apartment of her best friend's grandmother, even though she had nothing to do with the disappearance, and Anne also spent the early part of the afternoon at the Jewish Community Center, where a completely different sex offender was attacking and harassing young girls. It's interesting to look at the earliest media coverage of this case, where there was so much focus placed on this mysterious man with the white floppy golf hat, who would soon be identified as Ralph Barry Barber, and I could definitely understand everyone believing that he was the guy. But it sounds like Barber's alibi was pretty airtight, as he had eyewitnesses placing him at a trophy shop in Lexington, which is over 70 miles away from Louisville. I know that witnesses can sometimes be mistaken, but we have three employees who distinctly remembered Barber because he walked into the shop and asked to have his name inscribed on a plaque near closing time, which would have been between 5:30 and 6 p.m., the same time period when Anne went missing. Unfortunately, even after Barber was ruled out as a suspect, it sounds like the composite sketch of the man in the floppy golf hat was still circulated for a while, which may have hampered the investigation. It was not until January of 1984, 6 months after Anne's disappearance, when Gregory Oakley first popped up on the radar as a potential suspect after he was charged with his attack on 13-year-old Lee Mooney. However, I think this part of the investigation might have been complicated by the fact that Lee just happened to be the daughter of a Louisville police officer. Obviously, this made the department extra motivated to nail Oakley to the wall. But while the investigators on Anne's case were allowed to question him, it sounds like they were instructed to tread lightly, as I'm sure they didn't want to do anything that might jeopardize his prosecution for the attack on Lee. In the end, justice was served, since Oakley received a 30-year prison sentence for that crime, and a Jefferson County police detective named Bobby Jones still wanted to press him on Anne's disappearance. But Jones was instructed to turn over the case and all the materials he had to the FBI, and for whatever reason, their investigation into Oakley went nowhere. It sounds like this transition caused some issues, as one of the key pieces of evidence, the ATM receipt placing Oakley at the Bashford Manor Mall on the afternoon of Anne's disappearance, went missing without explanation. When the case went back into the spotlight again in 2008, Jones actually offered a public apology to the Gottlieb family, as he believed he should have been more aggressive about pursuing Oakley back then and not have let the case get away from him. But before we talk any more about Oakley, we have to discuss the other major suspect in this case, and that's serial killer Michael Lee Lockhart, who made a confession from death row in 1990. Like many convicted serial killers, Lockhart bragged about being responsible for additional murders he had never been charged with, and while I'm sure he was exaggerating about certain things, he was posthumously linked to a famous case which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries. You might recall the story of 16-year-old Kathy Hobbs, who left her Las Vegas apartment on the evening of July the 23rd, 1987, in order to make a trip to the supermarket, but was abducted and murdered before she returned home, and her body was later discovered in a remote field. This really did not become public knowledge until years after Lockhart's execution, but investigators have closed the case because they are now certain that Lockhart was the perpetrator, as there was forensic evidence linking him to the crime, and he could be placed in Las Vegas at the time Kathy was killed. Knowing that, I guess you can't completely discount the possibility that Lockhart also could have been responsible for Anne's murder, as he was stationed at Fort Knox at the time she went missing, which would have put him in close proximity to Louisville. However, it sounds like the authorities concluded that Lockhart's confession was false, and he provided no corroborating evidence to support his claims. When he looked at a map of the area where Anne was supposedly buried, Lockhart said he could not pinpoint the exact location unless he was on the ground, so arrangements were actually made to fly him from Texas to Kentucky in order to participate in the search. They found nothing, so I get the sense that this was a case of a condemned inmate with nothing left to lose, deciding to make a false confession because it allowed him to take a plane trip and gave him a temporary reprieve from spending the last several years of his life in a cell on death row. During an interview they gave in 2010, Anne's parents stated that they had not completely discounted Lockhart's confession, and they had also lobbied the authorities to perform a second search near Fort Knox during the mid-1990s, though this never came to fruition, and it sounds like investigators remain 100% convinced that Gregory Oakley was the real perpetrator. In their eyes, this case is about as close to solved as you can get without a conviction and the victim's body. But once again, while there is a compelling circumstantial case against Oakley, there is no physical evidence or a smoking gun to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it. I think one of the most frustrating elements is that there was ample opportunity to pin the crime on Oakley while he was still alive. In addition to being questioned when he was charged with the attack on Lee Mooney, one of Oakley's fellow inmates, Charles Cavins, actually came forward in 1992 and told investigators that Oakley had confessed to Ann's murder. It sounds like they believed this story when Cavins was re-interviewed in 2008, but why didn't they act on this information 16 years earlier? While I've mentioned numerous times on the podcast that you should always be skeptical about stories which are shared by jailhouse informants who are notorious for often making things up in order to help themselves. When Cavins originally spoke with police in 1992, he was looking to make a deal, and given that Oakley's alleged confession had taken place 3 years earlier, it doesn't sound like he was doing this out of the goodness of his heart. When Cavins took some polygraphs, the results showed that he was being deceptive, so I certainly don't blame investigators for initially discounting his story. But here's the complication. Even though Cavins might have been telling the truth about Oakley's confession, it sounds like he fabricated certain details. Cavins claimed that the main reason Oakley told him about Ann's murder is because he had recently read a book about how DNA testing was starting to become a tool in criminal investigations at that time, so Oakley had become concerned that the murder could be linked to him. Since Cavins was scheduled to be released from prison sometime in the near future, Oakley asked him to dig up Ann's body and burn it in order to destroy potential DNA evidence before he reburied her remains. It seems likely that Cavins made up this part of the story because investigators told him that they would only make a deal if the information he provided led to Ann's body, but in actuality, he had no idea where she was buried. When Cavins was re-interviewed in 2008, he left out the detail about being asked to dig up Ann's remains, which might explain why he was able to pass a polygraph this time around. So while Cavins' overall story about the confession might have been true, if he had not fudged certain details back in 1992, when Oakley was still alive, the investigation may have gone in an entirely different direction. However, the most credible detail which Cavins provided was that Oakley had told him he injected Ann with Talwin, a drug which was often used on animals. As a former veterinarian, Oakley probably would have been familiar with Talwin, but it seemed unlikely that someone like Cavins would have even known what Talwin was, and fabricated that detail out of thin air. It sounds like Cavins' story had more credibility in 2008, because Oakley's former girlfriend, Virginia Bailey, had just come forward with new information to incriminate him. As you recall, she claimed that Oakley returned to their home about 5 or 6 hours after Ann went missing, and asked Bailey to wash some bloody clothing, even though Oakley had told investigators he was out of town on a business trip during this particular time period. In actuality, Bailey said that Oakley had left on this so-called business trip the day before, and she was not expecting him to return that night. It sounds like the relationship was not in a good place at that point, because weeks earlier, Oakley had invited Bailey to accompany him to Birmingham on what she assumed was a trip to meet his family. But Bailey was taken by complete surprise when she learned that the reason he had to travel there was to stand trial for attacking and drugging a 13-year-old girl in 1979. After Oakley was convicted of the crime and sentenced to time served, he returned to Louisville on May the 26th, just 6 days before Ann went missing. Regardless of whether or not Oakley was involved in Ann's disappearance, it's an indisputable fact that he was a vile human being who had a documented history of preying on young girls. If he did murder Ann, I'd argue that Oakley never should have been in a position to do so in the first place because he deserved to be in prison. It boggles my mind that he only got 2 years probation for drugging and assaulting his own stepdaughter and received a sentence of time served for the attack on the other 13-year-old girl. if they had locked him up for either of those offenses and might still be alive today. While he deservedly received a 30-year prison sentence for his attack on Lee Mooney, it sounds like that's mainly because he had the misfortune of going after a police officer's daughter. According to Charles Cavins, Oakley told him that after he injected Anne with Talwin, she started vomiting, which prompted him to lose it and fatally strangle her. Even though Oakley had abducted, drugged, and assaulted girls in the past, there was no indication that he was a murderer, so it's possible he was planning to let Anne go once he was finished with her, but Anne's reaction to the drug was unplanned. When Oakley attacked Lee Mooney 3 months later, he threatened her with a knife rather than attempting to drug her, so what happened with Anne may have prompted him to change his M.O. It's also interesting how Virginia Bailey described Oakley as appearing drunk when he showed up at their house with his bloody clothing, so I wonder if he decided to get intoxicated because he never originally intended to kill anyone. Oakley wore a badge as part of his job as a meat inspector, so it's been speculated that if he crossed paths with Anne, he could have used the badge to convince her that he was a person of authority in order to lure her somewhere. There's also been concern about the fact that Oakley worked in a slaughterhouse, which would have given him a convenient location to dispose of Anne's body. It's worth noting that Cavins has claimed that Oakley specifically told him that he wrapped Anne's body in a tarp and buried her somewhere, but Virginia Bailey said she once heard him utter these cryptic words about Anne, quote, "If they don't find her shortly, she will be gone, and they will never find her." Those words could mean anything, but one possibility is that Anne's body was buried in a place where a major construction project was about to take place, which would make her remains all the more difficult to recover. Now, if Oakley really was guilty, it seems like he had no qualms about taking that secret to his grave. In 2001, while Oakley was still incarcerated, a reporter from the Louisville Courier-Journal had attempted to speak to him about Anne's disappearance, but he wrote them a letter denying all involvement in the crime, stating, quote, "I have no reason to lie about this matter, because I am dealing with terminal lung cancer, which is already metastasized," end quote. Indeed, Oakley was out of prison and dead just over 1 year later, but as far as I know, he never admitted to anything. I know the authorities said that if Oakley had still been alive at the time they heard all this new information from Cavins and Bailey, they would have considered the evidence to be strong enough to charge Oakley with Anne's murder, even without her body or any corroborating physical evidence. In addition to the eyewitness testimony, Oakley had a history of inconsistent statements about his alibi, and ATM records did place him near the Bashford Manor Mall on the afternoon of Anne's disappearance. When you factor in Oakley's other sexual offenses with young girls, then yes, I really do not have much trouble believing he was the perpetrator in this case, but without a smoking gun, it would have been interesting to see if the evidence would have been strong enough to convince a jury. Since Oakley wound up going to prison only a year after Anne went missing, and spent nearly 30 years there until he died an agonizing death from lung cancer, then I guess you could say that justice was ultimately served in this case. But it still doesn't offer much comfort for Anne's parents, who have never been able to recover their child's remains and give her a proper burial. I know the Gottliebs have always remained a bit skeptical that Oakley was the perpetrator, but I can understand why they would feel that way, because it still allows them to maintain hope that they might find out what really happened to Anne someday. Believing that a currently deceased suspect killed your daughter and you will be unable to bring her home is a hopeless feeling to live with, so if by chance you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Anne Gottlieb which could bring this case to a conclusion, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I did something a little different from the norm by releasing an episode about a case which has been solved, the murder-suicide of the Benoit family. You probably know that I'm a lifelong professional wrestling fan, and Chris Benoit's decision to murder his wife Nancy and 7-year-old son Daniel before taking his own life has always haunted me, So I decided to put together an episode in which I detailed this horrible crime and shared my personal thoughts on it. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Melanie G, Jen B, Michaela, Meg, Kenny F, Yogi Sleuth, Gabrielle D, Jennifer L, and Carol. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Murder Mile.
Hey friends, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. I would be delighted if you joined me every Thursday for a walk through the untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders of London's West End, featuring hundreds of fascinating true crime tales you won't hear anywhere else. If you're looking for something different, the award-winning and highly acclaimed Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast is researched using the original police files. It's presented as a dramatization. Each episode is crafted as a labor of love, and it focuses on the victims' lives in an honest, detailed, and sympathetic way. Season 5 has just begun, so why not treat yourself to more than 150 episodes? If that sounds like your cup of tea, search for the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. Thank you.
I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June the 12th and 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I hold what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.